This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Here is CBS News Senior Business Editor Jill Schlesinger. Jill, the economy seems stubbornly robust, which means what? More interest rate increases?
Absolutely. I mean, after we got that jobs report for July, which showed more than 500,000 jobs created, I think that kind of gives the Federal Reserve an all clear sign or signal to keep raising interest rates. You know, their big concern is that they want to control inflation, but they're worried that by raising short-term interest rates, they're going to really slow things down so much that we won't get job creation. Well, so far, that hasn't happened. And I think that this jobs report really does show two things, which is the Fed's got to move it and keep raising interest rates, but also that wages are really continuing to lag the rate of inflation.
I'm sure this kind of frustrates people because a BAFO job market is good. So explain what makes that so dangerous.
I love that you use the word BAFO. So first of all, I love that. So it's not that it's dangerous. It's just that when the economy is creating all these jobs, the fear is that in order to fill open positions, that then employers are going to have to keep paying more, that wages will rise and keep rising because that's what workers will demand. But if that's the case, what we also know is that those wage increases themselves can create or sustain higher prices because people have the money to be able to pay for things. And I think that wage growth slowing down would be something the Fed would also be looking for in the subsequent jobs reports.
Okay, so settle a few dinner table arguments here. The Senate has passed this Inflation Reduction Act, which is what the Democrats have called it. But of course, Republicans say anything, but this just throws more money at the economy and will just force further inflation and presumably force even higher interest rates. Where do you come down on that?
I don't think it's going to create more inflation. I really don't. I mean, it's a long-term spend on certain things. It's not like you're sending out hundreds of billions of dollars in checks to individuals. So I just don't think it's going to have an appreciable impact on inflation in the near term. And when you have 10-year plans, they don't have immediate impact. They just don't. So I'm not sure that it matters. I mean, maybe it's nice that the deficit comes down over the next 10 years. We'll have to see. But it's not happening anytime soon. And I think one of the big issues for a lot of economists that I talk to and analysts is that they actually are very happy with climate being back on the table because they think that's a huge risk to economic growth in the future.
Really?
Yeah.
They think that the provisions in this bill will actually make a meaningful difference?
I don't know meaningful. I mean, like, we're kind of like 20 years late in doing anything about climate, but it means that it's at least on move from the back burner to the front burner. And, you know, there's a lot of firms when you think about what one of the Fed's other jobs is not just, you know, it's not interest rates, it's not inflation, it's not the labor market, but it's also supervisory roles over the nation's largest banks. And as the nation's main regulator, one of the things they're worried about is that climate becomes a big issue for a lot of financial firms. Like, what are the risks of doing business in certain areas of this country? What are the risks of the parts of the world that are where we are developing new businesses and lending money? And what is the impact on the overall economy? Has a lot to do with some of the Fed's big ticket items. They want to make sure that companies are paying attention to this. So it's kind of weird. You think climate has like a social part of it. It has a major economic part of it. You know, every time you have one of these huge storm, every time you have weird weather, it impacts the economy. And the Fed is quite aware of that.
I think I can fairly summarize the Republican argument as follows. If you really want to control inflation, and even if you want to control climate change, just build better power generation technology and let the market take care of it. There's no reason.
Well, it hasn't done so already. So that's a failed. That's already been proven as a failed concept.
So you have to subsidize things like electric cars, you're saying, if you want to see them adopted.
I think you do. I mean, we subsidize the internet, the creation of the internet. Why did that happen? Would it have happened? Elon Musk was subsidized to create electronic vehicles, and he turn that industry around so that now the nation's three largest producers are also doing it. So government's not all for bad. And I think that that is a real misnomer and has been part of some major trends in the economy and in progress.
If you had to guess how long this current recession, if it is a recession, is it a recession, by the way?
No.
It's not,
not a recession.
There's
no way we're in a recession if we created 500,000 jobs in July.
Okay, so then what do we call it? Just a
slowdown.
A slowdown. And this is going to pass by when?
Who knows? I mean, I think it's kind of funny. Here's the deal. Economics, we call it a dismal science. Right, because we always think they're looking to the downside. Mm-hmm. But really, of the more interesting part of that description is that economics is not a science. In fact, my mathematician friends say they scoff at economics. One of my friends is a mathematician. She's very smart. And she was very upset when her son said he wanted to study economics. She goes, that's a soft science. Why is that? Because you know what? There's not answers immediately and readily knowable. So I think we are in a slowdown. It is an engineered slowdown. We really have to put everything in context. We had an economy that was growing between, call it 2.2 to 2.8% a year from 2015 through 2019. The global economy shut down, iced over in 2020 because of COVID. We had fits and starts of opening, and then so it was sort of like thawing and then freezing and thawing and freezing. And anyone who's a cook knows that's not a very good recipe for treating your meat. No. But that has really disrupted what we know as normal economies. And it's going to take a while to get back to historic norms.
And that's why we all feel like a piece of meat.
Exactly. You know how we always say, like, seasoned investors. My dad was a trader, and he said, you know how you season a piece of meat? Uh-huh. That's how you become a seasoned investor. You get pounded a little bit.
CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Melatonin is considered to be a safer alternative to some other sleep medications, so let's find out if that's true by paging the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. There are new studies indicating that a lot of people are taking melatonin these days to get to sleep.
Yeah, melatonin is a widely used over-the-counter medication that people use to aid them in sleep. Oftentimes, they're trying to self-medicate for insomnia, but first of all, what is melatonin? Melatonin is a hormone that's secreted by our pineal gland, and it really helps to synchronize the body's daily circadian rhythm with the light-dark cycle. Now, what typically happens is that levels of melatonin in our blood slowly rise a few hours before bedtime, and essentially it sets the stage for the body to switch gears for rest and other nighttime physiological activities.
Now, how does it compare to other sleep medicines?
So a couple of them have been widely prescribed. Most people are familiar with Ambien or Zolpidem or Lunestra. And those drugs, physicians have become increasingly hesitant to prescribe because the FDA has reported a number of complications where people have become involved with complex activities such as driving while essentially still under the influence of those drugs. And there's been numerous reported cases and even some deaths as a result of these type of activities. So as the FDA, although the drugs haven't been pulled from the market, but as the FDA has become increasingly concerned and put out warnings for it, physicians have become reluctant to prescribe it and have looked for other so-called safer alternatives, and melatonin is thought to be one of those alternatives.
And that's over-the-counter, so there's no prescription necessary?
Right. It is over-the-counter, and what's interesting, in most countries around the world, it is a prescription medication, but in the United States, it's treated as a supplement, and so no prescription is required.
So it's a supplement usually has to be some kind of natural food substance, right?
Well, it falls into that category. But, well, first of all, melatonin is good for essentially resetting the clock. It works well for people who have jet lag, It works well for people who work shifts, say night shifts, and then have to go on to day shift and so forth. But what it really isn't that great for is insomnia, but it's being widely used, probably inappropriately, for the treatment of insomnia. And it's being used in doses that have been increasing over time. For example, if you're going to try and reset somebody's clock from jet lag or shift work, you would give them a dose of about a half a milligram. But people are now taking doses that are 5 milligrams or even way higher. Our pineal gland secretes melatonin in picogram doses. So 1 milligram is equal to about 1 billion picograms.
Yikes.
So even a half a milligram is 500 million times more than what our pineal gland would be secreting, or in that ballpark. And so when people are taking, you know, 5 and 10 and even 25 milligram doses, it's way out of line with being physiologic, and there can be significant consequences.
So even though it's a natural substance, you can give yourself too much of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one of the things that people have been sleep experts have been increasingly concerned about. You know, some of the adverse effects that people can have are things like headache, fatigue, dizziness, daytime sleepiness. And there have been some studies that have also documented things like impaired glucose tolerance, essentially, you know, acting like you have diabetes.
So are you saying you think this should become a prescription drug?
Well, I think that a lot of sleep experts feel that it should be, and it should be given by physicians under very specific circumstances. Having said that, physicians are recommending it in place of prescribing, you know, these other medications where, you know, the FDA has been concerned about, as I said, complex activities like driving while you're under the effect of those drugs. So physicians are recommending it, but the people who are actually specializing in sleep medicine are of the feeling that it probably should be prescribed as it is in other countries.
Okay, then one more thing. If you can't take the prescription sleep medications and melatonin is not a good substitute, then how do you get to sleep?
So it's a great question. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine actually recommends cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a type of mental health treatment for insomnia, as the first line of therapy for both adults and children with insomnia. And as I mentioned, typically mental health specialists provide this sort of brief but personalized therapy to help work on good sleep habits. And we have seen an increase in the amount of insomnia over the last 2 decades, and largely, it's been attributed to people spending more time on social media and blue light late at night, and it keeps them from actually secreting melatonin appropriately because of the, you know, complex interaction between light and our pineal gland. So the cognitive behavioral therapy is an attempt to address all of these sort of issues to help to improve sleep. So that's thought to be first-line therapy. Mm-hmm.
So don't take your phone to bed is what you're saying.
Basically.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Seattle's Morning News. In 2020, a bill requiring all public schools in the state to provide comprehensive sexual health education passed not only the legislature, but was also approved by the voters. There was a 2-year period for schools to prepare, and that means the upcoming school year is when that requirement kicks in. Each school district will select its own program so long as it meets state law requirements. Current News Radio's Hannah Scott has more on what that education will look like in the Renton School District.
Part of the requirements laid out in state law include education on preventing sexual violence. Chris Johnson with the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center leads that part of the education in the Renton School District.
Making prevention possible is multi-year, multi-strategy. We typically do 2 hours of lessons with each grade of students. So we work in small groups with students, usually just a classroom.
Now it largely focuses on affirmative consent.
When consent was first being taught, a lot of it was, you know, this message was like, no means no. And it was very yes and no oriented. And this affirmative consent really just goes into the fact that it's more than just a yes or no concept, that it's discussion, that there are things like power dynamics involved, that there are things like coercion involved in consent. And so just broadening that conversation a little bit, but then also teaching kids, like, you can get, like, based on your approach, you might be able to get consent. Just if you ask a certain way, if you approach people in certain ways, you know, that it is a conversation. So it's more about that sort of mutuality piece.
And that looks different depending on the age group of the students.
When we talk about consent with sixth graders, it is really having them understand what boundary violations are for themselves, very non-sexual situations. The biggest boundary violation that we sort of dive into is people coming into their rooms unannounced. Siblings wearing their clothing that they didn't want to wear. Somebody eating their food they didn't want.
When we get to older kids,
I think the alternative to what we do is we really sort of talk about the difficulties in or the real life challenges that people are going to face when we are educating them on this. So, you know, when we talk about consent, we will also ask, is this realistic? What are the things about this that don't seem realistic, that wouldn't actually happen in real life? So that's the conversation that we have that I think will really sort of get to the meat of things.
Bystander intervention, also a big part of the conversation.
It's very common that we, as myself, other prevention specialists, other well-meaning adults, we often tell students and adolescents, you know, if somebody is hurting you, if somebody's doing something that's confusing, to go tell a trusted adult. And what we have found out is that a lot of times our trusted adults, when the students come to them, don't themselves know exactly what to do.
And that doesn't always mean physically intervening with someone. He says that's great if you can do it, but it's about making sure that students have the resources they need to be able to help their peers should they come to them for help. And they'll also address things like sugaring when students engage with adults online as companions for something with monetary value.
So, Hannah, I'm having trouble visualizing what this looks like in the classroom. Do they do role-playing? Is it a series of lectures?
No, so I did want to point that out. I specifically asked that question because that was a big part of the controversy when this legislation passed, because there is curriculum in what is nationally known as comprehensive sexual health education that does involve role-playing. This specific program in the Renton School District from the King County Sexual Assault Resource Center will not involve role-playing. It is classroom-based. So again, like you heard him talk about there at the sixth grade, kind of middle school level, they really just have those discussions about boundaries. There's really not a sexual component to the discussion. Older kids, they do talk about sexual intimacy and more on that bystander intervention and a lot more about the consent. Affirmative consent is really such a difficult thing for everyone to grasp. It is, I think you and I had talked about it when this bill had come up, Dave, is that it really is making this a discussion. So before you're going to be intimate, having, I think it's described in law as enthusiastically, saying yes, basically, more or less, how it's described. But it's after kind of a back and forth discussion. And that's the reality of what they are going to teach these kids today, that you can't just take it at face value that yes means yes. Mm-hmm.
I heard him mention that consent can depend on the approach you take. So are they coaching kids and how to get
know it sounds weird, right? Like they're coercion. It's not that. It's because it doesn't just talk about the sexual component of this. We're talking about
well, if it's not sex, what are you talking about then?
So what they're trying to do here is, again, if you go to the starting at the younger kids level where you're talking about your sibling coming in and taking something out of your room, or you doing that thing to your sibling, they're trying to get a base education to kids to understand boundaries that will then kind of transform into their sexual adult lives. So they have that kind of respect for people's things, for people's boundaries, and don't take, I guess, so much. So that is kind of what that works like. And that's why you have that discussion about maybe you better, instead of just running into the kid's room and taking what you want, perhaps you can just approach that in a better way and make it a discussion.
Well, that sounds like that's non-controversial. I mean, daycare has been doing that for years, right? I mean,
And this shouldn't be controversial. Look, the fact is these discussions are going to happen. I like what they talk about bystander intervention as well, which is, like you heard him say there, that a lot of times the adults that we've been been sending the kids to all these years, they don't know what to do. So there's also an aspect about this that will involve engagement with the parents. That will include a podcast, by the way, that they'll have up on their website later this year, because parents don't all, they're busy. They don't understand affirmative consent. They want to know what their kids are being taught. All of that information will be available with the hope of helping those parents not only understand the material, but understand it well enough to continue those discussions with their children at home on their own, because it's tough. A lot of parents have a hard time with that, but that's what they feel like is important. Mm-hmm. I know time's probably short. I want to make sure I put in there that they are doing a pre-survey of students before they start this curriculum, and then a post-survey to see what the differences are in their understanding and their knowledge base, to see if this is working. That's kind of the metric to see if this is the exact model that they want to use.
Well, you've got about a minute here, and I want to ask you, is any of this stuff in this curriculum going to get me emails about the the whole grooming controversy that we were having a few months ago?
I don't think so. I think what there's a big aspect, I don't think I've mentioned, the social media aspect of this that will mm-hmm. be involved in the education. That is really to teach, again, we're talking about kind of the older kids group when you get into high school, to understand and recognize the dangers of what happens on social media. And he specifically pointed out to me post-pandemic, right? So many kids were home on remote learning. There was a major uptick in all kinds of sexual misbehavior and kind of grooming and targeting that was going on online. And you heard his last cut there. We were talking about the sugaring. Do you remember the sugaring mm-hmm. story I did a few months ago where kids are engaged in sometimes sex, sometimes just companionship with an adult that they've met online in exchange for not money, but some kind of something, a gift, if you will, that is of monetary value, that they are seeing a big uptick in. They want to make sure that parents and friends of other high school students understand that. So I don't think there's a lot super controversial here. I think there's a lot of important conversations and topics, and one that I hope that parents will engage with this group. Again, King County Sexual Assault Resource Center is great, and there's a lot of opportunity for everybody to learn some important information, I think.
Cairo News Radio, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now, not so harsh on the ears. Brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Some people have dreams of becoming major leaguers, while others just want a chance to be at bat. CBS's Scott McFarlane has the story of baseball dreams being fulfilled in an unlikely scenario.
How far can you throw it?
Ethan Briner wants to be a catcher, just like his big brother.
Oh, that is a wide curveball.
They're already working on Ethan's home run celebration. Briner's family lives near York, Pennsylvania, and was among the first to arrive when the York Revolution minor league baseball team donated their field for the day to a nonprofit called Beautiful Lives Project, which is traveling America this year staging games for people with disabilities.
Are you good?
Yes, I'm awesome.
For adults and children who say they are often left out when local towns and communities organize sports leagues and events. Carter Hutchinson was born 16 weeks premature with cerebral palsy. His mom says Carter suffers chronic pain and breathing struggles, but always has a sparkle in his eye when he talks baseball.
I can't imagine not having baseball. I love it so much. It brings us so much joy.
From town to town, Beautiful Lives Project finds and invites the local kids and adults with disabilities to play. And it's often the local minor league ball players and coaches leading the drills.
These events were dreamt up and organized by a young man who now brings them all across the country in the summer. A man who's also seizing his own opportunity inside the press box.
Thank you for coming out.
Bryce Weiler of Illinois, who's put together 20 stops this year from Boston to Minneapolis to here in York. Bryce is blind and discovered few people think to organize events like this, so he doesn't.
They're able to see how important it is to surround yourself with people and friends who believe in you.
61 people showed up for this event in York, who at no cost enjoyed the day of their lives. Just a grand slam. Scott McFarlane, CBS News, York, Pennsylvania.
You can feel that happiness through those. That's exactly how you were when you threw out
the first pitch. That's right. Somebody's having a good time there. 7:49, and now from the G and Ursula show, here are both G and Ursula who are going to resolve Colleen's scenario.
That's right. You know how much I love the Gina Ursula show, and I love listening to scenarios, and I'm always pitching scenarios to you guys, hoping I'll make the show, and I totally understand you have a high bar, but I'm hoping this one makes the...
anytime.
You know I'm yes. being flattering. So the scenario is the surveillance in neighborhoods and how you protect your children. So yesterday, hot day, as you know, I was inside with my oldest. My husband was outside with our youngest, who's three. She was on the trampoline. He said, hey, you know the rules, take your shoes off. She took her shoes off and also all of her clothes. So she's jumping on the trampoline,
she's three
years old, buck naked, cutest thing you ever. Of course, right? You're a parent. You're just like, oh, look at that. Then I realized, just based on the way my neighborhood is situated, at least three cameras may have taken footage of her jumping nude on the trampoline. Not on purpose, right? The neighbor's very polite, always try to be like, hey, I set this up. I try not to have it in your neighborhood. But I know that some of them do get triggered when we're in our backyard because I can hear it say, alert, you're on camera. What do I do? Do I ask my neighbors for that footage and to delete it? Do I let it go? Do I prevent my daughters from being nude in our own backyard when they're free and young? I don't know what to do in this new surveillance state, but I don't want my child naked on anybody's database.
Ooh. Mm. It's so sad that you can't just allow your kid to be a kid without having to worry about it showing up on a site that you, any pictures that you don't want showing up on other sites.
And it reminds me of what you brought up a couple weeks ago about the Instagram mom who posts cute videos of her three-year-old
and how she's getting skewered by other parents, but there are other parents who are really concerned.
But it's because sickos have taken pictures of her and say just her midriff and posted it because they somehow like to even look at three-year-olds in midriff. So not her fault. She's not posting nude pictures of her daughter, right?
Exactly.
I'm not trying to show my nude daughter, but she's being caught on everyone's cameras because we're paranoid about porch pirates.
Are you naked in your backyard?
No.
Do you ever get naked?
Not me.
Can I ask why you don't get naked back there?
I guess just on the off chance that like somebody might walk by and...
So why do you let your three-year-old get naked?
Because she doesn't have breasts and I don't sexualize my three-year-old and I understand as an adult woman that I can be sexualized.
And it is their backyard.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to... Yeah.
Why don't she get naked in her backyard? Here's where I'm going.
All right.
Here's where I'm going. You're probably right. There are sickos out there that can see you or your child back there naked. This is 2022. I assume that every time I walk out the house, I'm on camera. You know what I mean? So I think that we need to change our behavior to that.
This is also very triggering for me, though, because my whole life I've been told to wear a certain something or cover up certain things because my body might make, a male classmate distracted or might make my male neighbor gaze at me longer. So the fact that from 3 years old I have to tell my daughter, cover your body because other people are going to make it a problem, that's super triggering for
Right.
me.
If you know your neighbors?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What are the chances of them going through the video and doing anything with it? Probably
zero.
Bill Cosby had a show for years, so you just never know. But go ahead.
Yeah, that's true.
But is it overstepping to say, hi, this happened yesterday. Can I make sure it's not and delete it for me? Or should I just, whatever?
Well...
Isn't it?
I think your gut is telling you that even the fact that you brought it up as a scenario and maybe you bring it up to the neighbors and they say, oh, my gosh, I'll totally delete it. But then I know you're also thinking, now are they going to think I'm a perv?
Right.
Yeah.
That I think they're a perv,
yeah, they're a
right?
perv, exactly.
Which is not the case.
Yeah, exactly.
If there's a mistaken capture of nudity and you want to protect somebody. So.
Yeah. In all honesty, if it were me, I would just let it go. And then I would just think about it in the next... that sadly, you can't
position the trampoline.
Do you plan on letting this happen again, or is this the last time that'll ever happen again?
Well, the thing is that she did it without us knowing, right? It's not like we watched her take off her clothes and we're like, she did it within and then it happened, right? So you can't control your three-year-old at every moment.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's tricky though, right? With everybody's surveillance.
Yeah.
Like I said,
posted a recognizable picture of your daughter without your permission, I think you've got a lawsuit.
Right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave.
So they better at least pixel it out.
Yeah. Thank you, you guys.
Yeah, and I don't think, I think you're good, but it's something to think about the next time she wants to go on a hot day jumping on the trampoline, sadly.
Exactly. Thanks, Gene Ursula.
9 o'clock.
Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien along with Dave Ross and Chris Sullivan. You know, it seems like the polar bears have been in crisis for a while. Climate change, the primary culprit with their precious ice floats melting. But a new population of bears is showing some promise for their survival. We called up Kristen Lydra. She's principal scientist at the Polar Science Center at the University of Washington. Has been watching this closely. Kristen, what can you tell us from these bears in Greenland?
Greenland, yeah. So our study lays out the evidence for a previously undocumented and highly isolated population of polar bears that live on the southeast coast of Greenland. And these bears survive in a special way. The first thing is that polar bears need sea ice to survive. It's a platform they're critically dependent on. They use that platform to hunt seals and get fat and be able to reproduce and do everything a polar bear does. These bears in southeast Greenland live in fjords that are sea ice free for more than 8 months of the year. And that's just way too long for a polar bear to survive. They need more ice than that. But the reason these bears live down there and are able to persist is they have access to glacial ice, which is freshwater ice that comes off the Greenland ice sheet in the form of glaciers.
Why is that different? That, like, why is that promising? I guess I don't understand. An ice float's an ice float, whether it's sea or freshwater.
It's unique habitat, this glacier ice. It's not something we find all over the Arctic. It's fairly uncommon. But in Greenland, it is common because Greenland is a giant island of freshwater ice. So the bears have basically been able to make a living in fjords where they wouldn't otherwise be able to, because they can hunt seals off of these floating pieces of freshwater ice.
So the key is using the ice as a hunting platform. Is that right?
Exactly. Polar bears need some type of ice as a hunting platform. That is the way they catch seals.
Okay.
Their primary prey.
So does your study indicate that they might not be as threatened by the breakup of the polar ice as we thought because they're adapting or not?
No, I think that a really important message here is that loss of Arctic sea ice, that's the frozen ocean, is still the primary threat to all polar bears. And our study does not change that at all. Glacial ice, like what we see in southeast Greenland, may help small numbers of polar bears survive for longer periods under climate warming. But a really key thing is this is not available to the vast majority of polar bears. So most of the Arctic's polar bears still have this problem that the Arctic sea ice is declining rapidly, and that's going to affect their survival.
Would this be, and bear with me as I try to understand this, a situation where here in Washington, what we've done to help goats survive and thrive is we've helicoptered them from the Olympic Mountains over back to the Cascades. Could you do the same with Arctic polar bears and just helicopter them to Greenland?
Well, I mean, that's been discussed in the context of how do we save polar bears as a species. But, you know, Greenland already has plenty of polar bears, and polar bears in other parts of Greenland also use this glacial ice. So I don't really think relocating polar bears to Greenland is going to be our best single action. Really, what we want to do, what we need to do if we care about the future of polar bears, is have global climate action.
Yeah, that's going to be tough, though. I'm thinking you're going to need a plan B at some point. Could you just sort of set out a series of, you know, like swimming floats that never melt that they could use to fish from?
Yeah, I've heard that, too. You know, the thing is that it's not just the platform that matters to polar bears. The Arctic sea ice is like the foundation of the entire ecosystem. There's algae that grows on the bottom of that ice. It feeds all of the production in the ocean, in the water column. It feeds the seals that feed the polar bears. So you can't just put out some styrofoam floats and call it good. Like, you need that sea ice for the Arctic to be the Arctic and to support animals and an ecosystem.
I see. And if the polar bear population declines, what does that mean for the human population or for the land down there? What does it mean if polar bears disappear?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things that matter if polar bears disappear. They're an iconic keystone species that people care about. They're also very important to indigenous communities. They are a biological natural resource, and they're hunted for subsistence in many countries. So when you lose polar bears, people lose their sources of food and cultural identity and economy, things like that. And they're a critical part of the ecosystem. They're a top predator. in a system and you take out top predators, and we've seen in other systems that has cascading impacts.
So what can you do to rekindle interest in this? And actually, when I think of polar bears these days, you know what I think about? I think about Coca-Cola, because they have polar bears. They have polar bears in their ads. And I'm thinking, you know, if more companies just put polar bears in their ads so they became familiar, then suddenly losing them, you'd feel something there.
I mean, I think polar bears have been a symbol of climate change for a couple of decades now. And when people think about climate change, they think about polar bears. We're seeing impacts of climate change all over the place, including here in Seattle. I think the effects that we're going to have are going to go way beyond the Arctic sea ice and polar bears. So, you know, maybe there's some other things that could get people enthusiastic or motivated to do something about climate action.
Absolutely. So what's next with this study? Now that we know this isolated group of polar bears using the fjords of Greenland are thriving, what do you do with that information then for the species as a whole?
I should correct one thing, is that we don't know if they're thriving. Ah. So we actually don't know, like, if they're increasing or decreasing or anything along those lines. So there's a couple of directions we'd like to go. These are the most genetically isolated polar bears in the world. They're really special, and they add an important component of genetic diversity to the species. So we definitely have a lot more questions than answers. One of our first questions is how is this population doing? Meaning, is the population stable? Could it be increasing? Is it declining? And to do that, we need several more years of field work where we go to Greenland and we use a helicopter to take what we call genetic biopsies of bears. So we shoot a small dart into the rump of the bear, and it grabs a piece of fur and skin, and we can genetically identify an individual. And using that information, we can estimate how many there are.
How do you get the dart back?
The dart pops off the bear, it falls onto the sea ice. And then we quickly land the helicopter, and someone jumps out and grabs it while the other people watch for the bear.
Before the bear grabs you. Yeah, okay.
Before the bear turns around, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so, but these polar bears clearly have adapted. I mean, they're obviously related to the other form of polar bears, right? So doesn't that signal that other bears over time could also adapt to changing conditions?
Yeah, if they have access to this unique habitat. The key thing is that it's only a portion of the Arctic where this type of habitat occurs, and that is Greenland, which is a ice sheet, Svalbard, some islands that are to the northeast of Greenland, and some parts of the high Canadian Arctic, the eastern Arctic. But the rest of the Arctic, including the U.S. Arctic, does not have this habitat. So polar bears don't even have it as an option.
That's Kristen Lydra at the University of Washington. We appreciate the research, and we will continue to follow the developments.
Thank you very much.
8:48, Seattle's Morning News, and time for the Monday edition of Crime and Punishment. From domestic violence cases to eluding police charges, July turned out to be a pretty busy month for King County prosecutors. And Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott has the wrap-up. Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yeah, I did my weekly chat with Casey McNerney over at the King County Prosecutor's Office. He says in July alone,
there were 598 charges that we filed. And that's nearly 30 felony cases per day.
Casey says they prioritize violent offenses.
The majority of those nearly 600 charges that were filed in July, the priority is violent crimes and guns, and then repeat property offenses. Every day we're charging gun crimes, and that's anywhere from an armed assault to a case of an unlawful gun possession. We see often drug dealers moving fentanyl that we charge, and they also have a gun with them.
And Casey says there are a lot of misconceptions about how they handled drug dealing offenses.
That's one of the rumors that we hear a lot, too, is people say, do you actually charge drug dealers or why don't you? Not knowing that in July, we charged 26 drug dealing cases. And this is not, you know, a high school kid selling two joints out of his locker. This is most often somebody pushing fentanyl in downtown Seattle or meth or oxycodone or heroin. In many of those cases, they're also armed too. But so 21 business days, 26 felony drug dealing charges. That's what we're doing. And people don't often see that because those routine fentanyl cases, those routine meth cases are, you know, kind of run of the mill. They're not that attractive as a headline.
He says another misconception.
This is a myth that we hear all the time. I actually heard this just in person on Saturday when I was talking to a guy at a restaurant. He said, you know, they never charge felony crimes if you run from the cops. All you got to do is just run from the cops, not get caught. You're not going to ever get a felony charge. And that's a rumor that is not true. There were 11 people just in the month of July who were charged with felony crimes for trying to run unsuccessfully from the sheriff's deputies or police or troopers. You may get away, but they're not going to forget about you, particularly if you're running with a warrant too. And you know, when those cases are sent to us, we charge those immediately and pretty consistently.
So I do want to point out, though, he did say, as we heard, I believe, from the State Patrol earlier this year, they are seeing more people who run from the cops. But mm-hmm. if you get away, right, like if they don't catch you because they don't chase or whatever the case may be, that doesn't mean they don't know who you are.
They're not going to give up.
Yeah, they're gonna track you down. So and then you'll be charged when that's referred to the prosecutor's office. Something else that they see a lot of?
There's another rumor, too, that we don't charge assaults against police officers, and we do all the time. Just off the top of my head, I can tell you about 11 different cases in the last few months of officers who have been assaulted, and the person who assaults them is charged. There's certainly other cases of first responders, workers in ambulances, and nurses, you know, are assaulted.
And the cases they see the most of
is domestic violence. And that isn't talked about a lot because people understandably don't cover those stories in the news because you don't want to re-traumatize the victim and have their, you know, their personal details out there. But even with violent crime and repeat property crime being a priority and those commercial burglaries and drug dealings, and even with those cases, in terms of volume of the type of case that we see most often, it's domestic violence cases. And we've seen an increase at the start of the pandemic, and it's never gotten back down to, I guess, what you would call normal levels. There's not really a normal level, but, you know, that those heartbreaking cases happen at a lesser rate before, or happened at a lesser rate before the pandemic, and they've just never quite gone back down.
Another thing I want to note, we expect to hear more later this week from the prosecutor's office on recent operations around 3rd and Pike, specific to drug dealing offenses. Mm-hmm. There's apparently been some really good work and outcomes there. And unfortunately, as you may have heard in a newscast of Colleen's, that there is another case from last week where a 66-year-old man was beaten, it appears possibly yes. randomly, and he passed away over the weekend. So we expect some updated murder charges to come this week in that case.
Yes, I can vouch for 3rd and Pike. I was walking through there last week. Beautiful sunny day.
But, do not walk through there, Dave Ross.
There were other people walking through there, and it was a sunny day. And it was, seemed in a good mood.
When this man was attacked. Yeah, it was 3 in the afternoon.
And the city looked beautiful, and yet it's true. That's where they all hang out, and mm-hmm. You can see them with the razor blades and their little bits of powder there. And So I assume all those people then do get arrested at some point, but then go right back out there, right?
The people you're talking about who are out there like smoking the blues and doing that kind of thing, unless they assault somebody or kill
fentanyl.
Somebody.
Come on, we have to translate. Okay.
Unless they do something like that rises to the level of a felony or are dealing drugs, that's a misdemeanor. That's the Blake decision. That is the minor personal possession stuff that they don't charge. You're maybe if you get a cop who interacts with you, they'll have to refer you to, hey, do you want some treatment? That's all they have to do. And you can say no, and that's it, and that's all. There's no court involved, no prosecutor involved at that point. So there's little they can do about those folks unless they do something that rises to a felony, which doing drugs in public does not.
I see. Well, that explains it. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com. We'll be right back.